Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am your host, Sal, and along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder to those that are joining us live, if you scroll down a bit to the show page, you'll see a link to the chat room. You can go ahead and jump in there with the usual suspects, and that's a great place where, in the course of a show, if there's a question you would really like for us to address to our guests, or if you think there's something that maybe we've missed that we should bring up, just bring it up there in the chat room, and we'll do our best to roll that in as the show goes forward. And if you're new to Midrats, or in the course of today's show, you've got to jump off, but you want to catch what you missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can just subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes. Now, let's get on with the show. We have a little bit different format today. We have two guests, but they both kind of revolve, I think, around a central core. You know, for the maritime professional, there are a couple things that we all have in common. We all have a high interest in our institutions and also a good respect for our history. We're kind of going to hit both of those topics today from a slightly different angle. For the first half of the hour, our guest is going to be a rather unique institution that we have here in the United States. That would be the United States Naval Institute and its CEO, Vice Admiral Peter Daly, USN retired. And we're going to just take some time to discuss the Naval Institute, where it is in the national security arena and that idea, that marketplace of ideas and where it stands, and also how ideas and concepts today help inform and influence the direction of our Navy going forward. In the second half of the hour, we're going to the other end of the pay chart, and we're going to bring on Ensign Chris O'Keefe, the United States Navy. He is the producer of what I think is a very interesting program that kind of builds off other subject areas that other people have done. He is the producer of the United States Naval Academy podcast series, A History of the Navy in 100 Objects, that uses objects from the Naval Academy's Museum to help tell the story of our Navy and the nation it served. But that's enough of my prattling. Let's go ahead and get on with the show and introduce our first guest, Vice Admiral Daly. Welcome to Midrats.
Well, glad to join you today.
Excellent. And we really appreciate you taking time this Sunday to come join us. And I think to start off with, obviously, you know, we've got a good handle on what the Naval Institute is, but a lot of our listeners may just have a partial picture, and we have a lot of listeners from overseas as well who may not be as familiar with it outside of perhaps one of its publications. But just for the, to start as a touchstone here, when was the Naval Institute founded? Who founded it? What were the people who originally founded it? What were their goals and aspirations? And what has remained constant at the Naval Institute since it's founded? And what are the things that it's doing today to keep itself relevant and to adjust to changing situations and technology?
Well, it was founded in 1873 by a group of Navy and Marine officers who really felt that the Navy was lagging other navies around the world in technology, development, and they just felt they were falling behind. And their assessment was that they needed to move ideas up and down the chain of command in a way that wasn't necessarily based on rank. It's hard to believe, but they thought that the people at the top weren't listening. Who'd have thunk? So what they said was that they needed a forum where ideas moved up and down based on not what you're wearing on your rank, but what you're wearing for the quality of your ideas. And they said, if we get enough of these ideas, we'll pull them together and publish them in a proceedings of the Naval Institute. And the next year, Volume 1, Number 1, was published in 1874, and it's been continuously published ever since. There's nothing quite like it. As you said, it's unique. Nothing quite like it in any of the other services. And to this day, it serves Navy, Marine, and Coast Guard. Our mission today is to provide the independent forum for those who dare to read, think, speak, and write in order to advance the professional, literary, and scientific understanding of sea power and other issues critical to national defense. As far as the modernizing goes, I think the most important thing is to keep that vibrant connection and also use the new media and mediums that are available to us. So we spend a lot of time in the last 18 months to 2 years in that direction of upgrading our technology, and I can go more into that if you wish.
Well, let me ask you what the job of a CEO of the U.S. Naval Institute involves.
Well, somebody has to run the day-to-day operation. You know, we're the size of a small university press, and we're putting out about 60 to 80 books a year, the two magazines. And so you have the concerns of a publisher, but you also are a bit of a custodian of history, because we have the largest photo collection for naval photos outside the service itself. We're preserving history through oral histories, which the Navy doesn't do themselves. We do it for the Navy. And so you're a combination of a keeper of history and a small to medium-sized publishing operation that has this important mission.
I wanted to pull the thread on something, because in your introductory comment, I mean, you hit on something that has been a regular topic here. I know just off the top of my head, we did a show where we had both Vice Admiral Miller from the Naval Academy. We also had Victor Davis Hanson on. And one of the things that we talked about was getting the junior officers and also some of the enlisted really engaged in the conversation, looking for solutions, getting different perspectives. And that's always, you know, for a variety of reasons. You could have a one-hour show on each particular reason. And I know that both inside and outside the Naval Institute, there's been a great effort to get that engagement and ideas on. There's lots of reasons why people don't. But when I look at the February issue, and I know this isn't design, you only publish what comes across the transom, and that's why there's a big move to get more voices out there in many ways. But in the February issue, we had an assistant secretary of the Navy, an article by a retired admiral, retired vice admirals, a couple of captains, a couple of commanders, a lieutenant colonel, and one JO. We did have a lieutenant there. And I know that's not on purpose. That's just you get what you have coming through the pipe, so to speak. What are some of the efforts the Naval Institute has tried to get out there, both appealing directly to junior officers, but also perhaps influencing a culture of encouragement where we have more senior leaders, kind of like Admiral Stavridis, I thought was very good at this, that were making junior officers know, hey, publish. This is actually going to be good for your career. You're not putting yourself in danger. Put your eyes out there. Become part of the solution. Become part of the conversation. What are some things that we're trying to do to get more of those junior officers involved in the conversation? And what are some of the frustrating barriers that you come across in trying to get them to put the fingers to the keys and send something in?
Well, first, I'd invite your guests to look at our blog, because our editorial board, the real core to the answer to your question is that our editorial board is an extremely important mechanism to ensure we spread it around. And there's a guest post by Lieutenant Commander Claude Barraby, who's the chairman of our editorial board. And I think it speaks volumes that a chairman of our board is a lieutenant commander. And he has a post on February 13th where he went back over the past year plus and really looked at the dispersion of authors by rank and affiliation. And I'm happy to say that it came out as a very good spread. Over the past year, we're publishing more junior people and more senior people, more active duty people, and I'm very proud of that. I need that mix. As you know, the secret sauce of the open, nonpartisan forum is the give and take. And in order to be relevant, you have to hear some of the more senior views, but then you have to equally get in there and allow that exchange of ideas, which is so, so important. So what we do is we look at who the writer is a little bit, but we also look at what they have to say, and we try to start with the power of the piece, the power of the idea, but we also are not immune to who wrote it. And, you know, what we need is both. I mean, I need the Lieutenant J.G. Hipples of the world. I need the Commander Dolans of the world, who were invited on a plane by General Mattis to join him on a piece of an itinerary to talk to him about his article on the Strait of Hormuz. And we also need those articles from the senior folks. Admiral Greenert's article, Payloads Over Platforms, was an important piece in July, and it got picked up around the world with coverage that was really extraordinary, over 12,000 web hits, and it was a notable feature in The Economist. So the answer is we think we need both senior and junior. I think I'm doing okay because I think a lot of the senior people are telling me that we have a lot of junior people writing, notwithstanding your February edition rundown, and a lot of junior people saying that, boy, we have a lot of senior people writing, so we probably got it about right.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. When you've upset everybody, that means you're doing constructive good. I've heard that before. Eagle One.
Well, one of the concerns I had when I was a junior professor, which was back in the dark ages, was that if you wrote something for proceedings, that I would be sticking my neck out because my level of ignorance, even then, I knew it was fairly high. But how do we reassure you, junior officers, they can stick their neck out, that they can dare to write, and it's not going to come back to them in some way as a negative on their and affect their career down the road.
Well, Eagle One, I could tell you, there's always going to be a few Luddites out there who can't believe that somebody would write and give an opinion that might challenge the views of the management. However, it goes back to the previous issue about who's writing in the magazine. One important positive that I see about Admiral Greenert, General Amos, and Admiral Papp writing in the magazine is that I take that as a signal that feel free to exchange ideas. And I was at a presentation that Admiral Greenert gave a couple months ago, and he says, hey, I want you people to write. And, you know, I take that as a positive sign from leaders who are comfortable in their skin. So I feel like the signal is there. You're right. It's not always there. I do occasionally get people who write in and say, hey, you're not going to believe, you know, I got my butt chewed because I wrote a piece in Proceedings. But, you know, we still have a good history here. We have people like Lieutenant Chester W. Nimitz, who wrote in 1912 an article about submarines that's still worth reading. And he was on his third command tour as a lieutenant, by the way. We had Lieutenant Commander King, whose medal for the prize essay is in the Naval Academy Museum. He said to his biographer he was most proud of that medal. And then right up to present day, you have people like Lieutenant Commander B.J. Armstrong writing pieces and writing a book on modern Mahan. That's, I think, in the end, the people who are published, the people who are on record traffic, they're the people who will move the dial.
I know the Luddites are also a challenge, and another personality type that I know the Institute has pushed against is the skeptic. And, you know, you have to keep reminding people that, the Naval Institute really is a unique institution in the fact that it's non-governmental, it's not-for-profit, it's a professional society that really tries to create an open forum for the sea services. But there are always people who are going to look at it askance because it is, you know, within extended gun range of D.C., so to speak. And because of it's been around so long and it has some institutional gravitas, for lack of a better phrase, a good reputation, there are always going to be people, whether they're politicians, whether they're in industry, uniformed senior leadership or even retired senior leadership that's now out in industry, that may make an effort to either steer the Institute a certain way or to drive the conversation. What are the efforts that you make to make sure that in both actuality and also in practice that the Naval Institute aggressively protects its independence and can continue to be looked at as a place where you can publish ideas and get involved in the conversation without somebody thinking that you're writing it because somebody told you to or you're trying to get a job with industry, but to keep that ethos of an open forum? How do you defend that best as CEO?
Well, I think the most important thing, again, is the editorial board process, where we work with lieutenant commanders, commanders, captains, majors, and lieutenants who are really young and independent minds. And we also try to spread it around. You know, one thing I've had to look hard at is if you're publishing the same person repeatedly, when do you digress? You know, when do you cross that line between independent thought and perhaps, you know, furthering a single person's agenda? So we look at that very closely. The other thing we've done is tried to modernize, and I referred to this earlier, but, you know, modernize our offerings. You know, by offering the blog, it's a curated blog, but you're getting the unfiltered opinions of whoever writes in. We're also trying to provide USNI News as something in between the monthly cycles of the magazine, so people can get information quickly and hopefully just the facts, Joe Friday, from our online editor, and contributors who write small mini articles in the 700 word range. So I think by opening up more media, by ruthlessly trying to adhere to an independent editorial process, and frankly, by encouraging people to submit, because we, as you already alluded to, we are only as strong as what's submitted. And that is an area where I've spent maybe my biggest effort, is to prime the pump, is to encourage people to write. I think you guys know what I mean, is that somebody can write an article about a hot topic, but in their tribe, in their part of the Navy, there's a few people who are the guy or the gal on that topic. And we're trying to get more of those voices as well.
Well, I would like to add that I think the addition of the huge benefit and the app that you guys have for Android phones and things like that, those are great modern additions to enhancing the communications position. A few months ago, you were talking about how you had reinstituted members' meetings. What was the purpose of reinstituting those?
Well, as you know, we're not organized like some other groups where we don't have regional VPs and chapters all over the world. There's one Naval Institute. But what we felt we needed to do was to listen more and sense more. And one thing I thought we were leaving on the table was when we went out to conferences like West, we had our big West conference in January, which was a terrific success. We bring a good chunk of our staff to an event like that, and it just seemed like it was crazy not to have a completely separate, focused member event, separate from the conference, to engage with our membership on the West Coast. And so we've been doing that. We did two straight now, and we're getting good results. And in addition, we're refocusing our annual meeting on April 11th. So we can have more content, which was a big feedback item I got. And then afterwards, combine that with author recognition for our 2012 award-winning authors and another member-type reception event in Washington. So that engagement is yielding us great feedback. And even from a work point of view, it's giving us better product and some new leads on both proceedings articles and books.
That kind of answered part of the next question that I wanted to ask you, Vice Admiral Daly, is, you know, back when I was a midshipman and I got, I still don't know how I got it, but I got a guest, somebody got me a membership at the Naval Institute and been a member ever since. I looked at it, okay, this is the place that publishes the magazine, and oh, look, they sent me a book catalog. And I've sent quite a bit of money over to the Institute over the year because I'm a book geek. But there's a lot more to the Institute than just, you know, the magazines and the books. And you touched on it right there is the conferences. And I think the member meetings in addition to that is a great idea because the Institute does do a lot more than just publish. For instance, over in the chat room, somebody brought up the China panel. And these can have, you know, second and third order effects of the national security conversation, so to speak. What are some of the other things that the Naval Institute does that perhaps a lot of people aren't aware of, and how does that impact the conversation for the maritime professional?
Well, thanks for asking. First, just on the conferences for 30 more seconds, our two big conferences are the West Conference in January, and then we have our big East Joint Warfighting-focused conference in May, 14 to 16 May, in Virginia Beach. Those two conferences we do with a co-sponsor, AFSEA. And frankly, we weren't driving the content of the conference enough from USNI. So one thing is we've stepped up our game big time in being a true co-sponsor, and our weight of effort on the conference content, and you know, we're carrying our weight now in a big way. And I think the program, especially out at West, we had all three service chiefs, you had the vice chairman, you had the commander of the Pacific Fleet, and others, it really showed. But the star there was Captain Jim Fennell, who was the intel officer at PAC Fleet, on the China panel. And we had over 10,000 views on our Naval Institute YouTube channel just for that panel, and it went everywhere. So that makes your point there. But in addition, we're doing oral histories, something that we raise money for because we think it's important to preserve history. Not only do we have the books and transcripts, but we also have, you know, thousands and thousands of hours of original tape of famous Navy voices. One of the things I want to unlock through preservation and digitization, and we've already mentioned the history and heritage, the photos, and I mean, all those things add up, the books, the magazine, not just proceedings, but naval history, the photos, the oral histories, and the conferences to our total content.
If you happen to be the father of a naval officer and perhaps a soon-to-be naval officer, I wanted to give... this is inside baseball for you, I'm sure, but if I wanted to give a gift to one of these people from the Naval Institute, in addition to a subscription, what would you choose, Admiral, for someone like that?
Well, I mean, I would start with proceedings, but I also think that the deal we offer where you can get both, you know, membership and the proceedings go together. Proceeding is our flagship publication, but for, you know, like 22 extra bucks, you can tack on Naval History, which is a damn fine magazine, and it's something that I think has appeal. It's not just for people who are truly historical artifacts themselves. I think it's got appeal to young folks. But I think I'd start there and then let them get into the books and use that, you know, membership as a discount. And with respect to parents, you know, I got to tell you my own story. When I was a small kid, you know, 5 years old, just learning to read, my father fed me a steady stream of Naval Institute proceedings, and I still have every one in my house since March 1958. And you know, when your young mind is a blank slate, you can memorize a lot of information. And it helped me throughout my whole career to have read those magazines and read all those Naval Institute press books.
Yeah, Admiral, I think the effort y'all are making to go back and to digitize some of the previous editions. I managed to get my paws on some pre-World War II editions, and it's interesting how ideas and challenges, they do echo through history. A lot of the problems we think we're having right now, many other generations of people have had to go through too. And though you can't exactly duplicate what they did, some of the issues and the challenges and ideas that we're thinking up in 1923 are very much applicable to 2013. And along those lines, with the change in history, is I'm one of those people. I know my biases, but I think the death of publishing is announced a little bit too early. But the a lot of what the Naval Institute publishes is nonfiction. There is a little bit of fiction, like our Claude Berrabet's has now gone into the nonfiction realm. Have you seen along the lines of what he has done, and of course, Tom Clancy did military-related fiction. The Naval Institute has see any further interest in going down the fiction route, vice the nonfiction?
Well, if it's nonfiction that's in our topic area, and I think fiction, excellent fiction, can be a wonderful medium to teach and convey important points about our topic area. So the answer is yes, we're open to that. I would tell you right now, we're not emphasizing it in any particular way, over one over the other, but if people bring us that kind of material, we greet it with open arms, and I think it can be extremely effective.
Well, sir, I know that you've got a couple of, but I'm not sure it's quite a conference. You've got this asymmetrical warfare thing coming up here fairly soon, and coming up that people would be interested in. How can they get access to another, what other good things we expect from the Naval Institute in the next few months?
Well, things coming up, we do have this on 2 April. We're working with CACI on this asymmetric conference, and I'm hosting a panel with Robert McFarlane, with Bob, Vice Admiral Bob Harward, Dr. Bob Kadlick, and we also have the Deputy Undersecretary for Homeland Defense in that panel. And we're going to discuss deterrence and how you can use deterrence in the asymmetric realm, even if you're dealing with non-state actors. And I think it's going to be terrific. And if people want to come, we're inviting all our Northern Virginia members. Mailing is going to go out very, very, very quickly here, like a quick email mailing. But if you find that you don't get it, send me an email, and we'll sign you up. But coming down the road, you've got the May conference at East, and we're really trying to focus on, the idea that our conference model is the winner here. I mean, people had us down and out for the count at West because all that craziness was going on. I mean, I don't have to tell you guys how grim it was looking for the conferences. And we were very pleased that naval leaders showed up. And they're going to do the same thing for all the services at East. And our model, where we bring a relative handful of folks to a large concentration area of people who serve, we think is the future. And we're really looking forward to that. Looking down the road, we have a history conference in the fall. We do at the Naval Academy. This year it's going to be on the history of manned and unmanned space. We're working with the two astronauts who are on the Naval Academy staff on that. Very exciting. So as we progress down the road here, that's kind of the next 4 or 5 months. There's a lot of good stuff going on.
Well, that gives a lot for everybody to chew on here and to set their calendars appropriately. Vice Admiral Daly, CEO, U.S. Naval Institute, thank you very much for taking time this Sunday to come on. Really enjoyed having you as a guest.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate the invitation.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And continue to enjoy springtime as it slowly shows up.
We look forward to it.
And I want to thank everybody. That was our first guest, the CEO of the U.S. Naval Institute, Vice Admiral Daly. And now let's go on to the second half of the show. We're kind of going to shift focus to the other side of the pay grade scale. We talked about history a fair bit with our previous guest, and we're kind of going to pick up that and run with it as well. Really looking forward to our next guest. Our next guest is Ensign Chris O'Keefe, United States Navy. He's the producer of the U.S. Naval Academy's ongoing podcast series, The History of the Navy in 100 Objects. The first two have already come online over at my homepage. You can find some links to them. But what they're doing with the 100 Objects is they have dug around in the closet over at the U.S. Naval Academy Museum and have found 100 things that help tell the story of our Navy and the nation it serves. Chris, welcome to MidRats.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Happy to be here.
Great. Hey, just to start things off, what is, besides the broad outline I gave, what is the 100 Objects Project and where did you get the idea?
Well, it's, as you said, a series of 100 different objects and artifacts located at the Naval Academy. The bulk of them are located in the museum, but there's also several located buried in the archives of the Nimitz Special Collections, as well as a couple more iconic ones around the yard that people are familiar with. We kicked it off with John Paul Jones' tomb, which everyone, most people who've been to the Naval Academy have seen, had a chance to talk about. But I got the idea from it a while back. I spent actually a couple years outside of the Navy doing other things, working in Africa, but also did a hike on the Appalachian Trail, and I hiked from Georgia to Maine, did a through hike, and after a while, it gets really boring. It's a wonderful experience. It's a lot of fun, and it can be tough at times, but it gets really boring walking every day, you know, 10, 20, sometimes 30 miles a day. So I would eventually start to listen to podcasts to sort of pass the time, especially on those real tough hills. And one of my all-time favorite series I listened to was the BBC's series, The History of the World in 100 Objects. I loved it. I listened to each episode probably 3 or 4 times. And then I realized, well, maybe at the Naval Academy or in the Navy, that a similar series would be awesome, because I started to learn more about what was in the museum and elsewhere on the grounds. And I realized a lot of really cool stories, a lot of really interesting stuff, but it wasn't super accessible beyond just the confines of the Academy. And what the BBC series had done was made it accessible, made the objects inside the museum accessible to everybody. So I thought, well, maybe we could tell the story of the Navy in the same manner. So in about 2010 or so, I started brainstorming on the idea, and I've been working on it ever since.
Eagle One, you there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Okay. I wasn't sure I'd lost you. I'm afraid my Skype connection isn't good. Plus, I was hoping this was MidRats, but instead he went with the BBC. So, oh well. Chris, I've had a chance to look at those first two presentations on YouTube, and they're terrific. I mean, they're information. Since I didn't go to the Naval Academy, I have no idea. I've never been to the Naval Academy Museum, so I have no idea what's in there, but I was really happy the piece on the political was really terrific. How did you get what prompted that? Was there a particular idea you had with using that topic?
Well, you broke it a little bit, but what I heard you saying is, how did I get the idea of the political cartoon? Is that
What brought
that particular object up? Okay. The Academy's museum has a collection of roughly 6,000 prints, only a very few of which are on display. This one actually is on display, but it's called the Beverly R. Robinson Collection, and it was donated by Beverly R. Robinson to the museum, and it's got an amazing spectrum of courier knives and other sorts of prints. And I worked with the curator of the collection at the time, Rob Doan, and we sort of looked to pick out what would be an iconic print, what topic. It's such a neat collection. What could we do to, you know, what would one print would showcase this collection? And we found this obscure print, this political cartoon, and we said, you know, wow, what an amazing thing. Navy budget crisis 150 years ago, Navy budget disputes, you know, real vicious political back and forth. You know, there was talk of scandal, there was talk of, you know, Miss Man, it was fantastic 150 years ago, and it was like, wow, some things maybe never change. Maybe things aren't so different today. We always talk about a crisis today, but maybe this is just, you know, an ongoing step in the narrative of the Navy. And we're like, let's talk about it. So we did some more research and really delved into it. And you saw in that episode what came out the other end.
Now, online, people can see the first two editions, the two out of the 100. How did you come up with 100 objects? Is it something you had to, you got the 76, went, oh, God, I got to find another 24, or did you get to the point that you had to rack and stack to whittle it down to 100? And
well, it's a little bit of both. Okay.
No, go ahead.
It's a little bit of both. I got really into about 75. It was just no-brainers. And then there was probably another couple hundred, which I sort of had to rack and stack. And what we did is actually we've left a little wiggle room as we continue to look in the archives, look in the museum collection. Towards the end of the series, we have a little bit of time to sort of look at, well, what glaring holes in naval history have we missed, and what objects can be used to sort of bring those narratives, those themes to life? Because the idea is to use the objects as vehicles for different themes, Navy, for example, Navy budgeting, or upcoming, we have women in the Navy, we have code breaking. On Thursday, we'll be discussing code breaking. And this was actually brought about because in light of the recent hacking cases past couple weeks, we realized, well, maybe it's so applicable that we discuss this sort of type of topic today, because it really has gone way back to the very beginning when the Navy's tried to use code and took it all the way back to the very beginning of the early wars, all the way through Midway and onward. So it's a combination of different ways to get the objects, looking for themes, and then sort of what object best represents the individual theme. And that's where the list came from.
Consult with the staff of the museum about some of the choices, or do you have
Absolutely. Sat down heavily with the former director, Dr. Scott Hart, with the current interim director, Lieutenant Commander Barabee. I went to history professors. I went to museum curators, heavily relied on Jim Cheevers, the senior curator of the museum, Dr. Jennifer Bryan over in the Nimitz Special Collections and Archives. And I spent hours in the museum myself just pouring over every little exhibit, every sort of nook and cranny display, really trying to search out what would really be interesting and beneficial in what needed to see the broader public eye.
What type of selection, you mentioned you got through the first 75 with no problem. What type of, and I thought it was really interesting that you're number two with the political cartoon. I think number one was kind of an easy shot there. But what type of selection criteria did you use? Did you look for those items that were sublime in their simplicity, but their significance, things that might be more germane to a modern topic, or just stuff that grabbed up and said, hey, I deserve to be on your list? What type of criteria did you use?
There were several different sets of criteria. I said all of those would be applicable. A couple of them, some of the objects are quite mundane and rather, insignificant, but the stories behind them are so fascinating that it was just like, wow, this is just so interesting and so unique that we just need to talk about it. For example, and then also that they also tied into a broader theme. One of my favorite examples thus far was a sextant given to Oliver Hazard Perry by Robert Barclay, who was one of the British naval commanders in the Battle of Lake Erie in 1813. And he, we'll be talking about in the podcast, but basically at the end of the battle, Perry was very sort of chivalrous and sort of took care of all the British wounded, make sure that all the British wounded were brought to hospital ships, were hospitalized, were cared for. And in gratitude, he received from the British commander a sextant. So that was an interesting story, but also we realized that we hadn't really discussed navigation in the Navy yet. So we told the story of the sextant and how it came into the possession of the Naval Academy Museum eventually. But then on top of that, we took a little broader step back and looked at navigation in the Navy and how had it changed from, basic calculations and dead reckoning to the sextant to charts and maps all the way to GPS and digital charts of today. So it was a variety of fluid criteria, ranging from obviously well-known objects needed to be used, things like John Paul Jones' tomb. They are no-brainers. others in, within the museum collection itself, or, which are prominent, things like a presentation sword given by King Louis to John Paul Jones in recognition of his bravery in fighting against the British at the time. It was a custom-made sword. And what we then did was we thought, well, who would be a great person to talk about this sword? Well, Admiral Miller, the superintendent of the Naval Academy, actually came out, and he came over to the museum, and we actually took the sword out of the case, and he held it, and he had actually did some research himself, and we talked about the background of the sword, and then it gave him a chance to talk about the development of midshipmen a little bit. So it was really a combination of factors when choosing all these things, and what stories could they highlight, what stories do they innately have themselves that could be talked about.
As you dug into this stuff, what surprised you the most about the things you learned as you went along?
Wow, I mean, it's the connections. It's the absolutely the connections. I mean, the most obscure objects have such weighty connections with other things, and the way the history of the Navy is so intertwined and so connected. I really didn't expect it. Just everything really connects in some form or fashion. So the broad, cohesive narrative of naval history really fascinated me as I started to delve into this project. And looking at how when the Japanese surrender documents were signed, what artifacts that are located in the museum now were present on deck, which also had been historical, had been with historical events in and of themselves. Certain flags belongs to Perry. The chair, every artifact during which was used during the surrender ceremonies had its own significance, its own historical significance. And the way that whole dynamic played together just fascinated me, and all those connections came together. It just blew me away, and that's when I really started to really get into the project. And it helped to have people like Jim Cheevers and Dr. Harmon, who have been doing this for so long that they could just tie it all together. And Jim Cheevers, if you go and talk to him, he can just from the beginning of the Navy's history all the way through whatever object we're talking about, he could set the narrative and could guide my research all the way from where these nascent stages of naval history into the modern era. It was just that's really what was fascinating for me.
And Chris, you graduated from the Academy last year, I believe. So
yeah.
You're a little closer to this, and it is kind of builds off a question we ask in the first half of the hour. Is I have my own biases here. I come from a liberal arts background, and I'm kind of a history fanatic in a lot of ways. But and a topic we've raised here a few times is not just at the Naval Academy, but also for NROTC guys as well. There is an official and defined bias towards a technical education in the Navy, kind of, and is at the expense of perhaps exposing and spending more time on things that might actually be more valuable to somebody who's deployed. Like in my career, I never ran into an officer who couldn't do his job because he was in an engineering-related area, though he's a philosophy major. But I sure ran into a problem when I had to strip out a map and explain Central Asia to a group of people who had no idea that Russia once had an issue with the Indian subcontinent. But is there an emphasis enough in the education that you received as a midshipman and what you see with your peers in history, regardless of major? And even if you are, because we do need nuclear engineers and other such items, but even in light of the requirements for a technical degree and a very technical line of work, are we doing enough to make sure that people who are leading sailors and Marines overseas are able to intellectualize why they're going, where they're going, and some of the challenges they may see, because they do have a foundation in history? Do we need to do more to educate with history, or do we have the right mix?
I think you always need to do more to find balance. I think if any institution which is not looking at itself and constantly sort of seeking to improve is failing in and of itself. And I think I received a wonderful education at the Naval Academy. Now, I had the benefit of my background is a little funky in that I left the Naval Academy after a couple of years, and I spent a couple of years outside of the Academy working. And then I actually reapplied. And what I realized was that the first time around, I did not grasp the benefit of, of the Naval History class. And actually, Commander Barraby, who became my academic advisor at the Academy and who helped me start this project initially, I slept through his entire history class my freshman year. And, you know, I did not grasp the benefit of it. So what I would say is that I would say the structure at the Academy is definitely there. And I'd say we need to focus on ensuring that everyone throughout the ROTC or Academy and down to the most junior enlisted sailor, it gets that the message and the knowledge gets delivered in such a way that it connects and it makes sense and it understands the significance of why they should know these things and how. Because I did not grasp that significance early on. It wasn't until I started this project that I really got how understanding this history, understanding the history, the dynamic of the complexity of the conflicts and the issues we find ourselves facing today. It's just it's a much more complex world than it was, you know, in previous years, just because there's a lot of gray area, there's a lot of uncertainty, and you have to sort of rely on your knowledge of nuance and of processes more than maybe one might have had to before. So I think we should focus in the future in bringing perspective and understanding to the system, to and understanding why we should be listening in these history classes and getting better. I think the structures are there. It can always be improved, but focusing on balance and understanding would be key, I think.
Yeah, I think Tom Cutler is at least the author of a book on naval history for naval personnel. Have you had a chance? Is that a book that you would find useful, and could people tie that to the stuff, the work objects?
I have skimmed his book. I have not had a chance to read it, and he actually gave me a copy personally, because Tom, I interviewed him at least a dozen times for various portions of the podcast, and what he did is he, using his sort of great knowledge of history, and I mean, he's also editor of the Blue Jackets Man. I mean, he brings a lot to the table, and he was one of the people that really, in my opinion, can grasp the whole narrative, not only how the history played out, but also how it continues to affect us today. But I think those are super useful. And tools like his book are super useful in bringing, you know, history, especially to our maybe some of our more junior sailors. But I also think we need to take advantage of, and what I was trying to do with this project, we need to take advantage of newer forms of media that are maybe more visually stimulating and engaging. Because it's one thing to read a book about something. It's another thing to see a video up close and personal of a sword, of a Medal of Honor, and then you see it then followed by a photo of the recipient or maybe a clip of an interview. I mean, I think I love to read, and but I think there's something more. I think you have a more of a connection with being able to see and hear something than just read about it. And because it's, especially in the light of budget cuts and things like that, using these new forms of media is sort of a cost-effective way, like the podcast, which I was trying to use to do this, just that, I think is a useful tool which should not be overlooked. And I'm hoping that the series sparks more, and that this is only the beginning of a mobilization of a new way, a new sort of return to an understanding of our naval heritage. Because what I love about the Marine Corps is, my father was a career Marine, is that they really embrace their heritage, and they talk about it. And every junior Marine is in touch with the iconic leaders of the Marine Corps, and they feel part of something broader. And if we can use, starting with tools like, you know, Tom Cutler's book and then these podcasts, we can use all these forms of media to sort of bring a renewed focus on the Navy side of the house, on our heritage. I think that will, in the long run, really help shape the future of our Navy and also help us guide us through the various difficulties we're going to have to face over the next few years.
You know, you made a real good comment. The Marines do an outstanding job of inculcating their culture and their history. And I think that's why I never could have been a Marine, but I've had the honor of working closely with them on a few occasions in my career. And I think that informs and influences how they do their business, how they work, how they take care of their Marines, because others have led by example, and the Marines, they inculcate that history with them. And that's why you see a lot of the standard procedures, attitudes throughout the Marine Corps. They want to make sure and emulate the best history. And I think we could learn a lot from how they do that. And also, somebody mentioned something in the chat room about having a Bull Halsey hologram. I think that would be a nice counterpart to the Global Force for Good program. Of course, you'd have to believe every third word. But, you know, what does Admiral Halsey have to say? Kill, 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 et cetera, et cetera. But what I wanted to ask you for, as we knew me, I am a narcissist, have delusions of grandeur, but the sword that you mentioned earlier, when I first saw that, I immediately went into like a mental outline. I'm a big fan of the TED series of discussions where you'll have people who will have an object. One of my favorite was the chief of staff of the Dutch army just used their main service weapon as an object to discuss the gun and how the gun is actually a instrument of peace. It's a great discussion that anybody who is not in the military, I think, really needs to see it. It's in English. It's not in Dutch. But that sword, I think, is one of the things that you look at when you know what it is. And you think of the second and third layer of what went on around that sword, who had held that sword, what the circumstances were. It has a lot of meaning. And when I was thinking about your concept that you're working on here with the 100 objects, in the course of going through and getting those 100 objects, did you get hold of something that, as you thought about it, made you want to walk over to the next five people you saw, grab them by the shoulder, and just hold it up to them and go, let me tell you about this, something that, what object really grabbed hold of Chris and got your heart running?
I mean, I had these, and I worked heavily with I worked closely with a cameraman, Matt McMahon, who works at the Naval Academy, and he volunteered a time to help me out and do all this. And every time we did an interview, every single time, we'd be like, wow, that's amazing. Every time. I mean, it's tough to sort of pick one. So I'm thinking about that. But honestly, as you were saying, the sword did reach out and grab me for a bunch of reasons, because of, I had just finished researching, really understanding the interplay of post-American Revolutionary War into the French Revolutionary War, and I was thinking that, wow, as the American colonies were sort of struggling for freedom, supported by the French king, who then in turn had this sword produced at this famous armory to be given to one of the American heroes, he would shortly later be overthrown by his own forces, internally, which was set into the French Revolutionary War, followed by the Napoleonic Wars, of which the after effects would then spark, be partially responsible for the War of 1812, in which all of the historical great figures first made their names, and in command of ships like the USS Constitution. So it was just it was amazing that the continuation of history as it went through, it was just these ripple effects, and they just never stopped. And I just kept following the train, and it would eventually, all of a sudden I found myself in the 20th century. And it was like, wow, it was an unbroken chain of amazing, amazing events sparked in part by these objects that these objects were a part of. So the sword was one of them, but really all of them, literally every time we would finish just a film session, it would be like, wow, that's amazing. My mind is blown. I need time to think about all of the ramifications of what we just learned.
Have you had any contact after Hendricks or the Naval Historic Center people about this?
Naval History and Heritage Command. Yes, I've actually in the past couple of weeks I've been communicating with them more and more. My dream for this in the long term would be that this would be this sort of style of learning, that this could be a springboard for a lot more, and they're interested, and they like and they're very supportive of the series. So I think hopefully they will, learn from this, and maybe it'll allow them to sort of shape their teaching of history in the future. And also people like, you just had Admiral Daly on. He and I spoke very closely last year, and he's going to be doing an interview with me for one of the upcoming podcasts because we're going to actually discuss the Naval Institute and talk about naval thought, and talk about, people writing, and Mahan, and other people who just write, who did help shape the way Navy doctrine is carried out and who helped shape the policies that we follow. But I haven't been in contact with them.
One of the great happy hunting grounds ashore for me, as I had a chance to spend a few years in Europe, what became greatly apparent to me, especially the British and the Canadians are right with them, is, you know, going back to, you were talking about how the Marines really emphasize their history, know their history well. And the Dutch do this as well, the Germans not so much. But especially the Commonwealth nations, they do, they'll get their staffs together and they will do a staff ride where they will do Vimy Ridge. They will do the Scheldt Estuary campaign. They will walk the battlefields. Different officers are assigned certain parts of the campaign, and it's they can go for 2 to 3 days where they will go and do this. And I always thought it was a lost opportunity. You know, the War of 1812, from D.C. up through Annapolis and north, there are some great potential battlefield tours there. And another thing that struck me about the 100 objects, it did remind me of some of the things that the Royal Navy does, the British Army, and just kind of out of left field here, have you had a chance to talk to any members of some of our allied nations who might be involved in similar projects, or have you seen something that is being done overseas that sparks an idea of your head of maybe, you know, 2 or 3 steps down the road might be an interesting project from an American perspective?
I have not actually spoke with anybody. I have, it's on the radar that I've done some research and sort of started to look into it. I haven't yet to see a similar series from a military perspective, but just in my limited research. But what I have thought about is exactly what you're talking about. It's really interesting you brought up the War of 1812. Since it is the 200th anniversary, finishing up the 200th anniversary of the war, and amazing thing, it's really interesting. I actually got to talk to the CNO a while back about it as well, and he mentioned, and we had been talking about before, the amazing parallels with the War of 1812 and today. So not only from walking the battlefield, you know, in the vicinity of the Beltway, which is very easy to do, to go discuss, you know, what exactly happened in the battlefield, but the structural parallels as well. I mean, you have a Navy that was under budgeted, that it had, and what it had done is it had to make do, and it was littoral focused, and a lot of it was dealing with piracy. So a lot of the connections, I think, you know, that I think we could think about and how we dealt with the issues back then as well as how we deal with them today. I think a lot can be learned from the historical solutions and bringing that forward to today as well. So not only from a historical perspective, but from a policy perspective as well, this kind of a series is helpful, and these kind of things are helpful, like you're saying, to really focus our effort in understanding the environment we operate in today.
What are you up to now? And you're releasing these podcasts twice a week. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what are you doing now? If I can ask that.
Like the upcoming podcast?
Well, no. I mean, what is your current naval assignment? Is it involved in this history stuff, or are you in flight school, sub school?
I'm on the staff of Naval Force Fleet, of Commander Naval Forces Southern Command. I'm on the staff there. Yep. So I work the night shift right now, 5 p.m. to 5 a.m.
New guy.
Hours. Everything happens during those hours.
Yeah, you need to work the street cred with the senior watch officer. He's like, hey, I was on a show with the vice admiral here. Can you give me some decent hours? But I guess you're looking at your CV a bit. You seem to have a little bit of adult ADD your own life, so you got to run 2 or 3 things going. But
I do. I enjoy being busy.
Well, obviously, because you've got a lot of balls in the air, so to speak. But we're going to keep an eye on you, Chris. We greatly appreciate you taking time this Sunday to come in for 30 minutes. And I would just like to encourage everybody listening. You can find a link over to my show page, or just, you know, Google 100 objects in naval history. I think that'll get you where you need to go. And it's really neat. And not everybody can get to the Naval Academy Museum, but there's a lot of our Navy and our nation's history there. And I think you've done a really great public service to bring those objects out. And hopefully we'll encourage some people to pull a couple of threads, maybe buy a couple of books they find interesting on some topic areas. And it's all good there, Chris. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us live or catching us here on the archive. Really appreciate it. Come join us again next week for another edition of Midrat. Cheers.